So I want to dedicate this the mini semester to try to giving clarity in a topic where there's generally not a lot of clarity around. And it's something that I've been studying pretty thoroughly for the last couple of years, and something that I think will help the more questions are asked, because we all have questions around the topic of Torah from Sinai and Masorah, understanding what comes from where. We look at a Beit Midrash, and Bidmo has a wonderful Beit Midrash. It's not quite as big, let's say, as some other Batei Midrash I'm familiar with that have just countless, seemingly countless Sfarim, and we call all of those things Torah. But did Moshe Rabbeinu really receive all of these things? And if not, then why do we call it Torah? And by what authority do we treat it as Torah? And how exactly did we get from Moshe at Sinai to what we have in our Batei Midrash or our library? Who has the authority to write a sefer and say that it's valuable and that it's part of our Masorah? These are all very legitimate questions, questions that most of us lack clarity around. And so we have, I don't know how many classes we'll actually end up having. What is it, like four or five, maybe, with different, I think next week is Yom HaTzimut or Yom HaZikaron, so we probably don't have class then. I don't know. So my point is, I'm going to try to consolidate a lot of information, about 3,500 years worth of information, to be in fact, into a couple classes to try to give clarity around the topic of Masorah from Sinai. And it's going to help to ask questions, both questions on things I just said, like, oh, I didn't get that, or can you clarify, or can you explain how does this work and how does that work, or I heard something different, as well as questions that may not be exactly associated with what I said, but just things that have always bothered you. And through there, we'll hopefully get to some clarity around our Masorah. So we should start with Torah miSinai. It's clear from the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to Har Sinai and comes down with the Luchot, and then seems to go back up, and then he gets more than just the Luchot, or sorry, he goes up, and then the Ten Commandments, and then he goes back up, and he gets the Luchot, and he breaks them, and then he goes back up, and he gets the second set of Luchot. There are a lot of trips up and down from Moshe Rabbeinu to Har Sinai, not a lot of clarity around what exactly he received there. So let's start with the basics, okay? So tell me, in your own words, what you think Moshe Rabbeinu received from HaKadosh Baruch Hu on Har Sinai. On Har Sinai, yeah. Okay, Torah Shebaal Peh. Would you limit it to Torah Shebaal Peh? Is there more than just Torah Shebaal Peh?
Maybe like some outlines for basic like halakhot.
Okay, so, and is that part of Torah Shebaal Peh?
Yeah.
Okay, is there anything in addition to Torah Shebaal Peh that, that he may have received on Har Sinai? Was there any of Torah Shebichtav that Moshe Rabbeinu received at Har Sinai? Yeah.
I thought that he got both.
Right, so presumably he got both, and the question is, what exactly did that look like? Right? Now, the struggle around trying to define exactly what he got in Torah Shebichtav is, you know what it says in Torah Shebichtav? It says that Moshe was asked to speak to the rock, and instead he struck the rock, and he was punished with not being able to enter into Eretz Yisrael. Right? Now, do you think that Moshe Rabbeinu received this on Har Sinai before he did that? So that would be, I mean, I don't know, you could make the argument maybe he did, but then you really call into question his decision to go through with the thing which he knew would be punishable by not entering the Eretz Yisrael. So, in terms of the actual Torah Shebichtav, it seems that he did not receive every piece of Torah Shebichtav while he was on Har Sinai. Right? That's why that's why our tradition has it that he received the Torah Shebichtav up until the point where he went to Har Sinai. But the parts of Torah Shebichtav from Har Sinai through his death and maybe even eight more psukim afterward, he received not at Har Sinai, but only later in the last month of his life. Okay? So we basically have two primary points where Moshe Rabbeinu received Torah Shebichtav. One, Har Sinai. Two, end of his life. And he arguably wrote stories as they were happening throughout. That's in terms of Torah Shebichtav. Right? When we say Torah Shebichtav, what we mean here is Chumash. Is Chumash. Right? What parts of Torah Shebichtav did he not receive at all? Or definitely, or okay, we'll put commentaries on aside for a second. Because commentaries I would put more in the category of Torah Shebaal Peh, right? But Nevi'im, he didn't receive. We generally include all of Tanakh in Torah Shebichtav. We talk about Torah Shebichtav. We include Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim. So here we're talking about Torah. Chamishei Chumshei Torah, Breishit Shmot, Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Dvarim. He didn't receive Yeshua, Shoftim, and Shmuel. He didn't receive all of Ketuvim. Okay? I guess depending on... I'm not going to confuse you, but maybe you. So back to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. That's the Torah Shebichtav that he received just from Bereishit up until Har Sinai. That is the Torah Shebichtav that he received. Now, what is the Torah Shebaal Peh that he received? Okay, so here's where we get into our first interesting debates. Okay, there is a debate amongst the Tanaim. I say Tanaim, I mean the period of the Mishnah, right? Who debated whether or not Moshe Rabbeinu received all 613 mitzvot at Har Sinai. All 613 mitzvot at Har Sinai. Both their title, like the mitzvah of tzitzit, the mitzvah of Shabbos, the mitzvah of, right? But that's all he got. Or whether he received all of the mitzvot and all of their details of the mitzvot that we have in the Torah Shebaal Peh at Har Sinai. So for example, the Torah says on Sukkot, you have to take a pre-Eitz Hadar. Okay? A pre-Eitz Hadar and an Anaf Eitz Avot. It's describing Lulav and Etrog. Okay? It's not so clear that it's describing Lulav and Etrog, but it's describing Lulav and Etrog. Now, there are specific nuances and laws around Lulav and Etrog. You know, for example, what is a Pre-Eitz Hadar? It doesn't say Etrog, it's Pre-Eitz Hadar. And then, you know, the size of the Lulav and Etrog, maximum and minimum, what's kosher and what's not kosher. So, when did Moshe Rabbeinu receive these laws? Okay. Was he just told in Har Sinai, hey, you know, Pre-Eitz Hadar, maybe even Lulav and Etrog, I'll tell you more details later. Or did he really receive all of the mitzvot and every detail of the mitzvot at Har Sinai? Okay, so one position says, yes, he received it all at Har Sinai. And the other position says that he received all of the laws and details around the laws throughout their 40 years in the desert. Okay? But, according to every opinion, by the end of that tkufa, by the end of their experience in the Midbar, okay, Moshe Rabbeinu had received all of the mitzvot in both their general rules as well as their specific details. Okay? And he had received, and he had been instructed to write down everything that appears before us in the Chumash, in those, in the Chamishei Chumshei Torah. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu died with 8 psukim left of the Torah, meaning the pasuk that records that Moshe Rabbeinu died is the 9th to last pasuk in the Torah. Okay? So there is a discussion around who wrote the last 8 psukim. Right? But other than that, It's relatively clear what Moshe Rabbeinu gave us. All of Torah Shebichtav, a question regarding the last 8 psukim. And when it comes to the oral tradition, he gave us the mitzvot and their details. Okay, he either received some of it, most of it, or all of it at Har Sinai, but at the very least, by the end of the 40 years. Okay, this is, broadly speaking, the Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh that we received from Moshe Rabbeinu. Questions on that up until this point? Okay. Where do we know Okay, where do we know, how do we know, let's say, where would you look to find those laws and the details of those laws which were given to Moshe orally in the Torah Shebaal Peh, right, that aren't written in the Torah Shebichtav, that aren't written down explicitly in the Torah? Where would you look to find these things? The Mishnah. The Mishnah is the first recorded place that actually wrote down the laws that Moshe Rabbeinu taught, was taught orally, and taught orally. Okay? Now, in case you're interested, the codification of the Mishnah actually had two very critical stages. Okay? First, there was a text of the Mishnah. What I mean by a text of the Mishnah, there was a process whereby Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi determined which of all of the laws that we had at this point in time, which were a lot of laws, which one of those laws will be included in what we call the Mishnah, and how they would be explained, and in what order. Okay? That's what Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did do. Most likely, it's a debate, but most likely, what Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did not do was actually write them down. This is, I want to call it a common misconception. It's not necessarily a common misconception because there is some debate around it. But Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, most believe that he did not actually write down the Mishnah. In fact, Torah Shebaal Peh was not actually written down in Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's time. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was concerned that there was so much law and there was no clarity or order to what we're giving over. So let's just come up with the kind of like a set version of what to give over. It was still oral. But they decided, we're going to teach you these laws about plants and these laws about Shabbos and these laws about... These are the laws, this is the order, and then they continued to give it down, to give it over. It was only actually written down together with the Talmudic discussions in the seal of the Gemara. That seems to be the case because even the Gemara seems to assume that there's a major problem with writing down the Torah Shebaal Peh. For example, there's a story where Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish were learning the oral tradition written down over Shabbos. Not written on Shabbos, that has other problems, but they were learning it written down. And this created some degree of controversy. So there's a question of how they wrote it down, what was allowed to be written down, what was not allowed to be written down. But it wouldn't have been controversial if at this point all of Torah Shebaal Peh had been written down. Okay? So what we have basically is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi determining, okay, all of these laws which we have been passing down orally, I'm going to kind of come up with, here are the key laws you need to know by topic, and continue to transmit those orally. Now, what about all the laws that were not included in the Mishnah? Where would I look to find those? Or what are those called, let's say? What is it called? A law for Moshe that was not included in the Mishnah. What is that called? That's a braita, exactly. Now, the word, actually, this has two meanings. The word bar in Aramaic can either mean ben, as we know, bar mitzvah, or does anyone know the other meaning of the word bar? I don't expect you to. It's just a random, you know, quiz question in Aramaic vocabulary. It means outside, right? So, for example, chayot habal are wild animals. They're like outdoor animals. So, bar is outside. So, braita basically means the teachings which were outside the Mishnah. Those were organized properly and put into something called the Tosefta. And those comprised, the Mishnah and the Tosefta, comprise the teachings of the basic laws of Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. The basic laws that Moshe Rabbeinu received at Har Sinai. But, and this is extremely significant, and this kind of is going to make you think much differently about everything I said up until this point. the Mishnah and the Tosefta is not just a what's the word? Transposed? What does it mean?
Transcribed.
There we go. It's not just a transcribed a version of what Moshe Rabbeinu received, and it's not exactly a novelty. You'll just read it, and it's very clearly not. Meaning, it's primarily a list of discussions around different laws, right? So, how did we get from Moshe Rabbeinu receiving and giving over a set of laws, a lot of laws, to one individual, and to many individuals? He gives it in a certain capacity to all of Israel, but in a deeper capacity just to Yehoshua. How do I know that? Where does that come from? So the first mission in Avot, where Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, Masra Yehoshua, right? Yehoshua, right? So he gives over. In a deeper capacity, Torah to Yehoshua, but does teach all of Klal Yisrael Torah. So how do we get from there to all of the discussions that we have in the Mishnah, and definitely we haven't even gotten to the Gemara and beyond, which is just only discussions at this point, but how do we get from Moshe Rabbeinu receiving the laws from the Kadosh Baruch Hu to the discussions that we have in the Mishnah? Okay. Does anyone have any thoughts? How did we get? Moshe Rabbeinu received a lot of laws, a lot of mitzvot, a lot of details of those laws at Har Sinai, gave them over to Klal Yisrael and to Yehoshua, and then they passed those on. And so how did we arrive at the Mishnah, where we have a plethora of discussions and arguments around every law and its details? Does anyone know? Does anyone suggest maybe how that transition happened? Okay, so I heard two things. Some things may have been lost, and some things may have been debated, and maybe that's one point. So excellent. Let's start off with the prospect of something being lost. Okay, is it possible that of the many things that Moshe Rabbeinu gave over, some of them were forgotten, or not given over properly, or not studied properly, and that caused us to forget a lot of our Mesorah from Sinai, and basically account for the different discussions that we see in the Mishnah and the Gemara? Is it possible that we can owe some of that gap to either forgetfulness, or that's probably not the right word, but some sort of dereliction in the learning, studying process? Okay? So who thinks that that's possible to suggest that? Okay. So there are many respected Jewish commentaries who claim that this owes that we owe at least a portion of our machlokot, of our debate, to forgotten laws over time. Okay, there is one notable thinker commentary who disagrees with this idea vehemently. Anyone know who that is? The Rambam. The Rambam led I don't even know the right word. The Rambam wrote very, very harshly against this idea. He's like, how could you speak so negatively about our Mesorah? Our Mesorah is strong. We know what we received. We preserved it. This is Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. These are the precious words that Moshe Rabbeinu gave, were given to God. You think that we would just forget it and not take them seriously? So, okay, I hear the Rambam's argument. But then the Rambam has to explain, okay, so, how did we get from Moshe's version to what we have or don't have now? Okay? So that's the gap that the Rambam needs to explain. Now, what the Rambam says is essentially that interpretation is not an unideal, unfortunate consequence of not learning properly. Interpretation of the text was an intended aspect of Torah development from the onset. Meaning, the idea that we would have a text which we would need to study and interpret and extract meaning from, right? And even debate what that meaning is, was intentional, explains the Rambam. In fact, there are specific ways that were meant to go about interpreting the text, that were meant to go about extracting information from the text, that Moshe Rabbeinu himself was given. Kind of like a key to unlock the text, in a sense. Right? So not everyone can just come and say, well, I read the Pesukim and I think they're talking about this. No, says the Rambam. There are set ways that HaKadosh Baruch Hu taught Moshe Rabbeinu that he was allowed to read and interpret the text through this methodology Moshe Rabbeinu received and passed on to subsequent generations. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? Great. So there are 13 primary midot. These are called the Yud Gimel midot, not of Kadosh Baruch Hu, of Rachamim, rather the Yud Gimel midot Shatora Nidreshet Bahem. It's very confusing. We have two things called the 13 midot, right? I'll say it in Hebrew and I'll say it in English. Yud Gimel Midot Shehatorah Nidreshet Vahem. What does that mean? Right? The 13 ways or principles or means by which the Torah is interpreted. Now, the truth is there are more than 13, but there are 13 primary means of interpretation pertaining to halachic or legal matters. Okay, so you ever heard like a midrash where the text says one thing and the midrash kind of takes it to a different place? And there's also a tradition about how to interpret stories of Torah. That's not in the Yud Gimel Midot. That's a different. It's a different category. Okay? That's why I said that there are more than 13. But there are 13 primary means whereby we can interpret the Torah in accordance with our tradition. Okay? These are called the Yud Gimel Midot, Shatorah Nidreshet Bahem. Some might say them in the morning right before Pesukei Zimra, between the Bracha and Pesukei Zimra. There's a slot, if you didn't notice it, maybe you'll notice it now, where you say the Yud Gimel Midot Shatorah Nidreshet Bahem. You also notice that there are more than 13 there. But there's 16 there. But it's a topic for another time. Anyway, so the Rambam uses this idea of the Yud Gimel Midot, which, by the way, everyone agrees to, the Yud Gimel Midot. The Rambam explains that we didn't forget. The things that Moshe Rabbeinu told us is that, hey, God told me that a pre-Eitz Adar is an Etrog. God told me that the Totafot in the Torah, I don't know what Totafot are. The Tefillin. Yeah, what we call Tefillin. Right? These two leather boxes around that, you know, that Jewish males put around their head and their arm, with straps, and we wrap around, and in the head there are four compartments, and in the arm there's one compartment. They all have the same psukim, but one's divided into four, different, papers, and one's all written in one paper. The Torah talks about that, and it just says totafot. Doesn't say leather black boxes with straps, and here's what's written about them. It just says Tosafot. Moshe Rabbeinu told us what Tosafot were. Says the Rambam, these things are clear. We never have machloket around the actual things that Moshe Rabbeinu was taught. We have debate in the domain of Torah interpretation. Now, there are those people who were experts in these 13 methods of Torah interpretation. They are our, historically, our, rabbis who you'll see in the Mishnah or in the Gemara. And the debates that they have are not around Torah Shebichtav, and they're not around Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, the things that Moshe Rabbeinu actually gave us. They are around the next level up, which are debates around the details of the laws, which are not written in the Torah, and which Moshe did not receive, but could be interpreted from the Torah. Now, people are different, and they have different minds, and they're supposed to, and there's a beauty to that. Right? And the text was written in a way where there could be multiple correct interpretations. Now, there can also be incorrect interpretations if you don't know how to use these rules, or if you don't use the rules at all. Those can be incorrect interpretations. But the debates that we have, right, in the Mishnah are not things we lost, says the Rambam. We preserve the Torah Shebichtav, obviously. We preserve Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. Then there is a third level of debates, which is around text interpretation. Now, any opinion which is extracted from the text properly through these laws, through this methodology that was explained to Moshe, is a legitimate halachic opinion. Okay? And let's say you lived in the community of the rabbi in the Mishnah who thought that the answer was mutter. Okay? And he told you, hey, the answer is mutter. Okay? And someone else in a different community said, no, the answer is aser. But they both followed the appropriate methodology that Moshe Rabbeinu has received, but they arrive at different answers because they have different minds and different opinions in different places, right? So then if you live in the community of the rabbi who said mutter, you know what you should do? You should listen to him. And if you live in the community of the rabbi who said aser, you know what you should do? You should listen to him, even though you're doing different things. It's legitimate. Now, you shouldn't follow the rabbi not in your community because you like his idea better, or you shouldn't jump back and forth between the different rabbis because you're crafting a certain version of things that work better for you, right? But you're allowed to do what your rabbi thinks. Now, at a later point, on a more national level, we came to practical conclusions. Now, when I say practical conclusions, right, what I mean is we as a nation want to know what to do, how to act. There are debates about things. You can entertain multiple options and their legitimacy intellectually, okay? But in order to behave, okay, you need to know what's right, okay? You can sit and listen to an argument and say, you know what, I hear both sides. I see where both people are coming from. That's possible. But you can't act like both of them are right. You have to choose one. Okay. So over time, as a nation, we concluded how to act. That was not to preclude the legitimacy of the other opinion. We just needed a concrete way to act, and we had a process by which that was decided. Generally, how that process worked, at least in the time of the Mishnah, was a vote whereby we followed the majority. And we assume that the answer that the majority held was a more appropriate way of acting. Okay, and that was how different opinions, different perspectives, and arguments started entering into our Masorah, and how we resolved those arguments through a process of voting, basically, and we followed the majority. Now, we held on to the opinions of the other side because it was a legitimate opinion. We just didn't act that way. We needed a way to act. Now, in a desperate situation, right, sometimes we would invoke the other opinion and say, well, listen, it's a desperate situation. We do not have the capacity to go about this in method A. And you know what? Rebbe Meir did think that B was okay. We have no other option. Sometimes they would follow Rebbe Meir. It was a legitimate opinion. They just needed a clear way to act. Right? So that's tier three. Again, we had Torah Shebichtav. We had Halacha L'Moshe Mitzinai. And then we have the debates that were spurred by the Yud Gimel Midot Shatora Nidreshet Bahem. Okay? Now, even if you're not the Rambam, everyone agrees to the debates spurred by the Yud Gimel Midot. The Rambam thinks that there's no forgetfulness at all. So he attributes all of the debates to people's minds working in different ways and people having different methodologies interpreting the Torah. Others say, yeah, there's that, and there's some forgetting over time. Everyone agrees that exists. The question is whether we forgot some of the things the Moshe told us at all. Okay. That's kind of tier three. But even those three tiers, what are our three tiers right now? Torah Shebichtav, Halacha L'Moshe Mitzinai, debates around the Yud Gimel Midot. Okay? Even these three tiers don't account for all the dinim in the Mishnah. You will find dinim in the Mishnah and the Braita that do not fit into these three categories. Okay? What are those dinim? What are those laws? Yeah, of course. Category number one, laws that are explicitly in the Torah. Category number two, Halacha L'Moshe Mitzinai. Moshe learned it from God. He gave it over to us. And we didn't forget it. Right? Because we cared. We were really careful about it. Some might say we did forget some. But we definitely remember most. Okay? Category number three is, there are different ways of interpreting the Torah. Different legitimate ways of interpreting the Torah. In future classes, we'll get into why. Well, like a whole section, just an understanding debate on a more like fundamental level. Why shouldn't there just be one way of understanding the Torah? No, we'll get into that. It's not our topic for right now. So there are laws that are extracted from the Torah and details that are extracted from the Torah through the methodology of the Yud Gimel Midot, and everyone agrees to that. Okay. And that is also, or I guess the discussion is whether that's the tier that the debates started. Some will say, no, debates already started by Halacha L'Moshe Mitzinai. Some will think that this is what Moshe got. Some will think this is what Moshe got. Some will don't know. Okay? But according to the Rambam, tier three is where the debates start. But everyone agrees that these exist. Okay? Now, that still does not account for all the laws in the Mishnah and in the Tosefta. Okay, what other laws might you find in the Mishnah and in the Tosefta that we haven't already accounted for in the first three tiers? It's obvious, but we're not thinking about it. The Rabbanans. Okay, because up until now, what we've been talking about is Deoraita, either God's word, written down, or Moshe's words passed down from God and onward, or debates around the deeper meaning of the text, which even themselves are generally regarded as Deoraita. It's a little bit of murkiness around that topic. minor differences, let's say, between what we learn from the Yud Gimel Midot as opposed to what is just written explicitly. Minor differences, but there are differences. Not our topic for right now, but if you're interested, afterward. Okay, now we're about to take a big leap from between tier 3 and tier 4. And that leap is Dirabanans. You will also find Dine Dirabanan in the Mishnah. Okay. Now, what were the rabbis doing? Exactly. What were the rabbis doing? Well, let's start with the first primary goal the rabbis had. Anyone want to tell me the first primary objective the rabbis had in crafting their halachas? What was like their first primary goal? Boundaries. Perfect. Okay? Because the Torah tells you something. And the Torah says, this you absolutely must do, this you absolutely cannot do. Okay? And A, we want to treat that with proper respect and proper reverence. Okay? And B, there are a lot of things in the Torah, and not all of us spend our entire lives studying them and train ourselves to be cognizant of every detail of them every second of the day. Okay? A lot of us lead relatively normal lives where we try to keep informed, but we have a lot of things going on. So it's possible we didn't know a halacha, and it's possible that we just weren't thinking about it, and a lot of things are possible. Okay? But they're really important. They're very, very critical. And based on just how critical they are, the rabbis crafted different boundaries in order to preserve those laws, in order to distance you from violating them. So here's a great example that we just came across in Pesach. Does anyone know what the punishment is for eating chametz on Pesach? Correct. Perfect. Okay. Now, does anyone know when you have to stop eating chametz on Pesach from the Torah?
Right before it starts.
So I hear right before it starts.
The morning.
That's
after we do the burning in the bit. Okay. So whether or not it's let's simplify things and say that the general consensus, though it's debated, the general consensus is the Isser De'oraita around eating chametz starts at exactly midday Erev Pesach. Okay? And we know that because the Torah tells us you may not eat the Korban Pesach while you still are eating chametz. And what's the earliest time to eat the Korban Pesach?
Midday
Erev Pesach. So we learn that the Torah does not allow us, the two domains don't overlap. Okay, there's Chametz time and there's Korban Pesach time. They don't overlap. Korban Pesach time starts from midday and on, so that must be when Chametz time ends. Now, when did you stop eating Chametz?
In the morning.
In the morning, and to be more specific, the fourth hour of the day, probably calculated from sunrise. That's how most people practice. Okay, so if we were to divide the day into equal parts, into 12 equal parts, or if we were to divide rather the hours of sunlight into 12 equal parts, okay, then you get your halachic hour. Sometimes that's going to be more than 60 minutes if there are a lot of sunlight. Sometimes it's going to be less than 60 minutes. Okay, and then from sunrise, let's say it's exactly an hour. Okay, just to simplify things, and sunrise is 6 a.m. Okay, then when must you stop eating chametz? By 10. Okay, now that's not what the Torah says. That's not what the Torah says. The Torah says I have till midday. I should have until 12. 6 to 12, midday, 6 hours. Okay? Punishment is karet. Right? And especially when you don't have like watches to know exactly like the all right, 30 more seconds for eating chametz. I had this like situation last year. I like ran out to get a muffin for my wife to eat, like right before, like Sof Zman Achilat Chametz, right? Our favorite blueberry muffin. We were in Boston. And I missed my turn on the way home. I don't actually live in Boston. And so like I quickly turned around. I'm trying to get back. I get there like 30 seconds after Sof Zman Achilat Chametz. And her mom's like, just let her eat the muffin. I'm like, it's not my decision. She can't. It's Sof Zman Achilat Chametz. Right? Like the idea that we would like be medayik by like those 30 seconds before you have like watches and clocks is crazy, right? But okay, that's the reality. That's what we're operating under. So, but the Torah says I have until Chatzot, right? But we're talking about an Isser Karet, and it's really easy to make this mistake, especially a couple minutes after Chatzot. So what did the rabbis do? They put a barrier around the Isser Karet of Achilat Chametz. Right? And they said, you have, from the Torah, you have until the sixth hour to eat chametz. And by the way, to get benefit from chametz as well. It's also us to get benefit from chametz. You can't feed chametz to your dog. You can't have a monetary gain from chametz. Now, everyone who wants to sell their chametz is having a monetary gain from chametz. Right? So you don't have up until Pesach to sell your chametz. You would have up until the sixth hour of the day to sell your chametz. Because you can't get benefit from it after that. Come the rabbis and say, you have until the fifth hour to sell your chametz, and you have until the fourth hour to eat your chametz. They're not arguing on the Torah, and they're not adding to the Torah, and they're not subtracting from the Torah. They're just saying, it's really easy to make a mistake. Let's be careful. Okay, that is the fourth type of din that you have in the Mishnah. The barriers, the rabbinic barriers. We don't think that these are deoraita. We don't think that these are from the Torah. We're not confused. The rabbis say, we know what's from the Torah. We're trying to protect it. Okay? This still doesn't account for all of the dinim in the Mishnah. There's one final category. One final category. And that is the rabbanans that are not even aimed at protecting a deoraita. Can anyone think of an example of a derabanan which is not trying to distance you from violating a deoraita?
Electricity on Shabbat.
Let's put that aside. It's an interesting discussion, but let's put that aside for now. Let's try to do a more clear example. Potentially, but they could reach the conclusion that that new thing that's discussed actually violates something in the Torah. Maybe. But the clearest example is what we call a takana. Okay? How about reading the Megillah? Reading the Megillah is a mitzvah ase midirabanan on Purim. You have a chiyuv midirabanan on Purim of reading the Megillah. Is that protecting anything in the Torah? Is that like a barrier for you? No, it is a rabbinic invention, basically. Now, what they're doing is they're taking a value, a Jewish value, a Jewish idea, something which is good, something which they deem as necessary, okay, and crafting a behavior around it. There are not a lot of these, by the way. There are about seven. Takanot derabanan, where the rabbi said this is so critical. We're not going to say the Torah said this. It's so critical, though, that we need to create a mandated rabbinic behavior around this concept. So you have Megillah, you have Adlakat Nerot, you have Brachot, you have... So these are just some of the examples. You have Netilat Yadayim. These are the things that the rabbis crafted. They saw it as a critical Jewish practice, even though it's not... It's not protecting anything in the Torah. These are the five levels of laws in the Mishnah. Basically, what we discussed is what did Moshe receive and where? How did he transmit it? Was anything forgotten? How did arguments start? And then how did we go from what Moshe Rabbeinu received at Har Sinai to what you would see written in a Mishnah. Now, it's important to note, and with this I'll end, like there's this perception that there's so many arguments, nothing's clear, everything's an argument, everything's a debate, everything's an argument. And it's like a Jewish joke, and there's some element of truth to it. But in reality, when you zoom out, we agree on about probably 99% of important Jewish principles and practices, and 90% of all Jewish principles and practices. The debates that we have fall around these tiny nuances in laws that may or may not have even been given to Moshe. But if you stop, this is what Rav Soloveitchik would do in Shir. Before he gets into the debate, he's like, okay, what are all the things they agree on? and he would like map out the area of halacha that's being discussed. Here are all the things they agree upon. And you see that it's like 99% of the content. And then it's like, okay, they have, though, the following discussion on this one teeny tiny element of the halacha. Okay? So that's how we get basically from Moshe to the Mishnah. And next week, I guess next week's Yom HaZikaron, but the next class in Mitzvah Shem will go from the Mishnah to the Gemara. We have to end because class is over, but I'm in the Beit Midrash, so anyone who wants to ask follow-up questions.